Well, it's a pleasure to be here today and to have a chance to summarize and rather quickly tell you about radiation epidemiology. Epidemiology is the study of the distribution and determinants of disease in human populations. And it is extremely useful because when you have experimental studies, it's still dealing with animals or cells and not with people. But one of the problems is, even though you are doing research on people in real conditions, you really can't tell them what to do, so that you have to take advantage of the situations that you're in, and they're not always the perfect experimental design. So we always have problems with biases and confounding. On the other hand, as I say, it's the only way you're really going to learn about what happens to people. So I'm going to try and tell you a little bit today about some of the methods and some of the limitations and strengths of epidemiology, then talk about some very specific radiation epidemiology studies, in particular the A-bomb survivors, and a little bit about some of the newer areas of research, such as Chernobyl. So as I said, they're observational rather than experimental. We don't have rats in cages, and people never do what you want them to. And it's also extremely expensive and very, very time-consuming. So that always makes things a little difficult. There's always the possibility of confounding or bias, so that when you're studying one group of people, for instance, and comparing it to another group of people, you don't know, are they the same socioeconomic status? Do they smoke the same amount? And you really have to sometimes make assumptions that aren't always correct. And that is one of the big problems with epidemiologic studies. And it's why people are always talking about the limitations of them. And you see in the newspapers one day, coffee causes pancreatic cancer, and then the next day, no, it doesn't, because there are always study limitations to epidemiology. There are always uncertainties in dose estimation when we're talking about radiation, and if you're talking about nutrition, there's uncertainty about how many cucumbers people actually ate over the last 40 years. So we try our best, and in radiation epidemiology, it's sort of easier than in many of the other fields like nutrition, because often we do have some way to measure dose, either a film badge if you're talking about occupational exposures, or if you're talking about medical exposures, you have the records very often from the treatment or the diagnostic exams. When we're talking about environmental epidemiology, that's generally where it's most difficult, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. Often we have a problem of multiple comparisons, and just from a statistical point of view, if you look at 100 different comparisons, quite a few of them are going to end up being significant, even though it's not a biological finding. So that's always a problem. And then there's the problem of low statistical power and detecting any kind of effects. And to look at low radiation exposures, you need huge, huge numbers of people. And as a result, as I said, these studies are very, very expensive and very time-consuming. So, for instance, in planning a study to look at pediatric CT scans, you need over 200,000 people to look at this. So the first question when you're trying to plan a study is you need the appropriate study population. And as I say, it has to be very, very large, and that's very difficult to do. And it's particularly difficult to do in the U.S. because we have very few national registries. So a lot of the studies that I'll be talking about actually have been conducted in other countries where they either have national population registries, national cancer registries. As I say, in the U.S., people move around a lot, and that makes it very difficult to follow them up. Let me go on. And you need information on potential confounders. Smoking, of course, is always the major one, and when you're studying lung cancer in particular, without knowing about smoking, you can make a lot of mistakes. There are basically four types of epidemiological studies. The clinical trial is certainly the best when it comes to methods, and there you really do have a nice design. You can put one group of people who are going to get a specific kind of treatment and another group of people who are similar or randomly selected who don't get it, and then you can compare them. But basically that usually is only done in studies of medical treatment. And we can't really do that very much in radiation epidemiology. So mostly we rely on cohort and case control studies. Those are analytic studies, and they both have advantages and disadvantages. We use cohort studies a lot in radiation epidemiology, where we start out with a group of people who were exposed to radiation for one reason or another, and another group of people who weren't, or a group of people who had very low doses and others who had high doses, and then we compare many, many years later to see what kind of diseases they develop. In terms of case control studies, you're using a different kind of approach. You're starting out with people who have a disease, and you're going to compare people who don't have a disease but are similar in terms of age and sex and other factors, and then you're looking back to see what kind of exposures they had in their history. And this usually is a little bit more difficult because it's very hard to choose the appropriate control group. And there's also a problem of what we call recall bias. When you're trying to find out about people's exposures in the past and you ask them about it, for instance, how many diagnostic x-rays have you had, people who have a disease generally will remember things differently than people who don't have a disease. So when we find things in case control studies, there's always a little bit more suspicion about this problem of recall bias, and cohort studies really are preferred. Ecological studies are very problematic, but they are very often used to generate hypotheses and then to be followed up using either case control or cohort studies. And they've been used a lot in Chernobyl. And what you do in this situation is you're taking just population groups and you're comparing both exposure and outcome on a population group basis rather than individually. And as a result, you can have a lot of confounding, and often you can come up with a wrong answer. And that actually has happened many times with radon and lung cancer, where population groups were compared, and since they didn't know about smoking, they actually came up with the answer saying, well, there really isn't much of an effect of radon in terms of causing cancer. And all the analytic studies have shown the opposite. So generally, it's sort of like our first level of study when you want to get a very quick answer, and just to give you a sense of how you should move forward. So when I'm talking about studies, keep in mind the kind it is. For radiation epidemiology in particular, what we're interested in doing is characterizing and quantifying the risk of cancer in populations exposed to radiation either alone or in combination with some other agent. And very often, for instance, when we're thinking about studying the effects of radiation on cancer patients, they often get other kinds of therapy, like chemotherapy, and so we have to take into account these other exposures. Or if you're looking at environmental exposures, when somebody's exposed to radiation, again, often they could be exposed to other chemicals. So why do we want to study radiation? Well, to me, the main reason, of course, is to get the information necessary to recommend or regulate protection standards for workers and the public. And actually, radiation is one of the few agents that has international groups that set standards, and most countries follow those. In the U.S., actually, we don't. We have our own national standards that are set. It's also very important in terms of modifying radiotherapy, and a lot of the studies that have been done in radiation epidemiology actually have moved to towards changes in radiotherapy, and suggesting that fractionation might be more important, or worrying, showing how certain radiation and chemotherapy together is not always the best combination. It can help in terms of understanding individual susceptibility. Are people more susceptible to radiation than others? And also just to learn about carcinogenesis in general. And although everybody thinks of radiation as causing cancer, I have to say it's really not a very strong carcinogen compared to many of the chemicals. And so that's another reason why you need such large numbers of people to study it. So just to give you a little sense of some of the history, in 1895, X-rays, as you know, were first discovered. And they've been used very quickly for medicine after that. And over the decades, they've been used more and more in different settings. Oops. In terms of epidemiology, some of the really important very early studies was one in the 1920s, where they discovered that women who were painting luminescence on watches ended up getting bone cancer from the radium. A very early study of radiologists that was done in England found that they had exposure from the radiotherapy and the diagnostic exams that they were giving. They often put their hands on them and so on, and that they ended up getting leukemia. And then in the 1950s, when they first started the ABOM studies, they found both increases of leukemia and then soon after increases of solid tumors, and later on lung cancer among uranium miners. And these are really some of the most important historical studies in radiation epidemiology. So there are lots of sources of radiation in our world. There's medical, as you all know, both diagnostic and therapeutic, environmental, occupational, and military. And here you can see some of the major kinds of exposures. I don't know if you've ever heard of the studies of the atomic bomb survivors, but they really are considered the gold standard in radiation epidemiology, and I'll be talking a lot about them. Medical exposures, you know, there's a large amount of diagnostic x-rays that are used, and seems to be somewhat a fashion that goes up and goes down. For a while there was a little bit less, and now there's a tremendous use of CT scans, so that the overall use of diagnostic x-rays is increasing. And radiotherapy for benign disease and for malignant. Again, the use of radiotherapy for benign diseases, again, seems to go down and up, but there's always some use of it. Environmental exposures, nuclear accidents. I'm sure you've all heard of Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. Fallout from the nuclear testing in the 1950s. Certainly the U.S. had many hundreds of tests. Many of them were atmospheric and people were exposed to radiation. But it was done by other countries, and there was a tremendous amount of global radiation fallout. And then emissions from nuclear plants. As you probably have heard, the public is concerned about living next to nuclear plants, just even from the routine emissions. And then some people just live in high background areas where there's a lot of radiation in the sands or the earth, such as in China and in India. And even if you live in the U.S. in Colorado, where the altitudes are higher, your natural background radiation will be higher than if you live in New York. Occupational exposures. There are most people think of nuclear workers when they think about this, but in fact there are actually more medical workers who have some exposure, so I'll talk about them a little bit. So mostly what we have known about radiation comes from studies from the ABOM survivors and medical studies where people received acute high dose exposures. But what people really are much more concerned about is the low doses protracted or fractionated over time. And because of the problems of the study size needed for low-dose studies, we really haven't had much information that you could get directly from populations until quite frequently. And in the past, most of what we knew about radiation risk was extrapolated from the ABOM survivors and sometimes medical studies. But there are some more data today, and I've tried to put the emphasis on some of these lower dose studies that I'll be talking about. This shows just the magnitude of the doses from different types of studies and exposures. The ABOM survivors, most people think of it as a very high dose study, but in fact it's really not, and the mean dose is about 0.25 sieverts or 25 rads. Nuclear workers actually get quite low exposure. As you can see, it's about 0.004 per sieverts per year. Environmental exposures are very, very low. Diagnostic medical exams really can depend. They can vary, and with the new spiral CTs, they can be fairly high, and people can get a large number of them, often one after another, but certainly over years. There was a time when teachers had to have a chest x-ray every year. That hopefully is no longer the case. So you can actually get a fair cumulative dose from having a lot of diagnostic medical exams. And radiotherapy, of course, you can have enormous doses. But both for diagnostic X-ray and radiotherapy, you're usually aiming this at one organ in the body or one small part of the body, and the rest of the body is not getting any kind of exposure. Whereas when you're talking about the A-bomb survivors, nuclear workers, and most environmental exposures, it's sort of whole body exposure, so this is kind of different. So I'm sure everybody has a different background in this room, and I don't know how much you know about statistics, but in general, when it comes to radiation, we have our very special kind of risks that we look at. Excess relative risk and the excess absolute risk, as opposed to just relative risks or absolute risks. And these describe the percent change in risk for a unit of dose for the excess relative risk, or the absolute change for a unit of dose for the excess absolute risk. And they both provide complementary information, and they can vary by gender, by age of exposure, time six exposure, and so on. And I'll talk a bit about some of these patterns. Whoops. So, Okay, so this is actually a picture of what's called the A-bomb dome. It is what remained standing after the A-bomb was dropped in Hiroshima. It's on the river, and they sort of keep it there as a monument to the destruction of the A-bomb. There, at the moment, we are just finishing a second report on solid cancer incidence, and this describes all the different risks for the different cancer sites from 1958 to 1998. And this, as I said, is considered the gold standard in radiation epidemiology because it's a very large population of about 120,000 people who were sort of a healthy, non-selected population. There's some disagreement about whether they were non-selected or not because they had to remain alive after the bombing. Of course, people who were close to the where the bomb fell, most of them died from not so much from radiation, but from fire and other kinds of trauma. People estimate that there probably were close to double this number of people who survived, but about 120,000 are included in the study. It includes people of all ages and both sexes, so you can look and see how sex and age can affect radiation risks. And there's a very wide range of well-characterized doses. They've spent, 50 years trying to figure out the doses for people in this study by originally going and interviewing them, finding out where they lived at the time of the bombing, what kind of building they lived in, how much shielding there was. There's follow-up from 1950 for the entire cohort, no matter where people moved, because there's a system in Japan of National Mortality Registry. In terms of cancer, however, there's only follow-up from 1958 when the Hiroshima and Nagasaki cancer registries were established, and there's only follow-up for people who continue to live in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So that does make the cohort a bit smaller. And what, though, is terrific, interesting about this study is that, of course, there's more than 50 years of follow-up since the bombing. So it teaches us a lot about the long-term risks of radiation. The limitations are, as I said, there's no information on cancer, solid cancer data from 1945 to 1958. A leukemia registry was set up in 1950, so there is information on leukemia from 1950. And we only have cancer incidence data, as I say, for people who remained in Hiroshima or Nagasaki. Oh, and if you want to look at treatment data for cancer, that they don't collect that. So for this second report, 105,000 people are included. Even though this is 50 years since the bombing, or 53 in this case, 50% of the people were still alive. And what's interesting is that 85% of those people who were less than 20 at the time of the bomb are still alive. And actually, this means that this is the largest study of people who were children at the time of exposure of any study. And we're looking only at first primary cancers because otherwise if we looked at second cancers, we'd have to worry about the treatment for the first. And as I say, there isn't adequate data in the Hiroshima and Nagasaki cancer registries. And there is this new dose system called DS02 that was just instituted, and those are the doses that we're using. And these doses were done by a joint committee of American and Japanese scientists, and it has evolved over the last 50 years, and this is the most recent system. So this shows the dose distribution for the lifespan study, which is the study that I'm talking about. And as you can see, actually, there are a lot of people who receive very low doses. The study of includes about 25,000 people who were actually not in Hiroshima on the days that the bombs fell, but were Hiroshima and Nagasaki residents and returned to the cities in the next year or two. So those people had no exposure, and they're just not here in this distribution, but of course they would be in the top group of less than 0.005 sievert. And as you can see, there are actually not very many people who received over one gray. It's only about 2,500 people. And although they are the ones that actually sort of push the dose response curve, it's a small number of people. So this just shows the number of cancers that occur in the study, and it's a very large number, 17,000 cancers in this 105,000 people. Japan has a very, very high rate of stomach cancer, and as a result, more than half of the people had digestive system cancers, and more than half of those are actually stomach cancers. So we can learn a lot about any of the digestive cancers in this study. They have a very low rate of breast cancer, so the number of breast cancers is really not very large. And one thing I forgot to mention, that in this cohort of 105,000 people, there's a large number of women. Yes?
Was the environment contaminated
that
the people stayed in? Was that
taken
into account?
Contaminated with what? You mean with chemicals?
No, with the radiation.
The radiation stayed around for a very short time. But yeah, it was taken into account, but it really was a very, very short time. This actually shows you the doses with the number with the number of cancer and the number of excess cancers and the attributable risk percent. And the attributable risk percent tells you how many of these cancers are actually attributed to radiation. And people always think that there were a huge number of radiation-related cancers. That's actually not the case. As I say, people who had very high doses of radiation generally died, not just because of the radiation, but from all the other conditions, so that we don't have many people who had very high doses. So as you can see, of the 17,000 people, only about 850, I mean only probably is not the right word, but 850 people have radiation-related cancers, and that's about 5% of the cancers. Now, I don't want you to think that I'm diminishing any of the risks from this, but again, a lot of the reason is the people who had high doses died early on from either radiation sickness or from all the other terrible conditions that were there, the fires, buildings falling, and so on. This shows the dose response curve, and one of the big issues in radiation epidemiology and radiation risk assessment is, what is the dose response curve? Is it linear or is it not? When you're starting out at high doses, everybody agrees that at high doses radiation can cause cancer. But what about low doses? There's a very big controversy about that. Can you just extrapolate down from high doses to low doses? Because as I said, at low doses, it's very hard to distinguish what's going on in terms of epidemiology. And in this study, we can extrapolate down, and at very low doses, we see a very perfect linear dose response. And there is no suggestion that there's any kind of a threshold in these data. This is shows some of the temporal patterns, and there are two very important issues in terms of radiation effects: the age that you were at the time that you had the exposure, and the age through time, what happens over time. And the two models that I had mentioned to you, the excess relative risk and excess absolute risk, describe these patterns differently, and they're both very important. As you can see here, this is the excess relative risk, and if people who were 0 to 9 at the time of exposure versus those that were 40 plus, the four different groups, and you can see that over time, as you get older, the risk, older at the time of exposure, the risk decreases, so that people who were young, who were children, have the highest risk, and that's why it's so important to continue follow-up to see what happens to these people. On the other hand, when you look at this, using an excess absolute risk model, you see a slightly different picture. And you can see here that people who were older at the time of exposure, they also have higher risks. So you have a very different kind of pattern, and they both tell you different types of things. I think the excess absolute risk is much more important when you're thinking in terms of public health, because you want to know what types of numbers of cases you're going to be dealing with. When you're thinking of the excess relative risk, it's generally more helpful when you're thinking of etiology and why something happened. This shows the sex ratio, and again, they're different to some extent. Women have a higher risk than men, and this is true even if you take out the sex-specific cancers like breast cancer, cancers of the uterine and the ovary, or prostate cancer. In fact, if you take those out, then the excess relative risk is higher. Women have an 80% higher risk than men. When you're looking at the excess absolute risk, it's not that different, but it's, you know, women's risk is not as much higher as men. And when you take out the specific cancers, then the risk really, there's no difference between men and women. So this is, of course, very important for everybody to know. Are all cancers the same? Do they all have the same risk? And as you can see here, this is for all solid cancers combined. And the risk that is highest is for bladder cancer, followed by breast cancer, lung, and thyroid cancer, and colon. They're not all, they don't all have the same patterns of risk. They change depending on gender, age of exposure, and attained age. But bladder, breast, lung, and thyroid pretty much always remain high. And this shows you the number, in particular, the number of excess cases. And of course, the number of excess cases depends both on what the radiation risk is and what the actual the spontaneous cancer risk is. So you see here that there's a large number of excess breast cancer cases because the radiation risk is very high, but you see a very large number of excess stomach cancers, and that's more because there are just so many stomach cancers in Japan. So one thing about site-specific risks is that it's really important to look at it, but it's very hard to look and find the real statistically significant differences. And when you try to compare the risks of all the different sites, it's very hard to come up with statistically significant differences between the sites. And so I think even though we certainly talk about differences, we have to think about it also in terms of the biological basis. Is there a real reason, biological reason, to think that these differences are real or not? Age at exposure, that's one of the questions that's always of interest. Now, for uterine cancer, cancer of the endometrius, up until recently, we never found any increased risk. And just in this last report, what we're finding is there's no risk overall. I mean, it's not a significant risk overall, but it is a risk for people who were under age 20 at the time of exposure. We haven't seen that before. So by having continued follow-up, you're able to find new things. You can also see that for bladder cancer, it doesn't make very much difference what age you were when you were exposed. For thyroid cancer, on the other hand, it's very different. And if you were exposed after age 20 or 30, there is not much risk, whereas if you were exposed as a child, there was a huge risk. And that we'll see when we're talking about Chernobyl. One of the very few sites where you see the opposite trend is for lung cancer. And here, as if you're exposed at an older age, you have a higher risk than at a younger age. And we think some of this has to do with smoking, but we're really not able to separate this out at this point. This shows the differences by male and female. And for bladder cancer, there's a huge risk for females compared to males. And for lung cancer, both of those are smoking-related cancers. And again, I think it has a lot to do with the interactions between smoking and radiation. And again, we don't have sufficient information to really be certain about all of this. For thyroid cancer, where thyroid cancer is much more common in women, not non-irradiated women, just in general, when it comes to radiation effects, we don't really see much of a difference. And for stomach colon cancer, there appears to be a bigger risk for men than for women. So in summary, when it comes to the A-bone survivors, I think it provides excellent information to show that there appears to be a linear dose response with no indication of a threshold. Women do have a significantly higher risk. You see this in some other studies, but it's clearest in the A-bone survivors. Excess risk continues throughout life, although it does seem to level off after about 30 years, but there still is an excess risk. The excess relative risk decreases with increasing age, exposure, and attained age, whereas the excess absolute risk increases with attained age. These age time patterns don't differ substantially when you look at the different cancer sites. I pointed out the ones that did differ, and they're also not statistically significant differences, but they are of interest. And although we've done this new analysis, most of the patterns are similar. We do find some new things. For instance, this is the first time we were able to see that there's an excess risk of male breast cancer. But the overall patterns don't change over time. So for medical radiation, as you know, I mean, obviously, it's absolutely imperative to have radiation for both the diagnostic purposes and therapeutic, but then the medical radiation can cause cancers as well. So one always has to keep that in mind when making decisions about diagnostic and therapeutic uses. There have been lots of studies of medical exposures. They're generally very small. What's good about them is that you have very good information usually on doses, so that those can be fairly precise. You have a broad different types of radiation exposure that you can look at. People are treated with all different kinds of radiation, and you can look at different organs and tissues. In the U.S., we use radiation a lot for medical exams, and as I say, with CT exams, it's going up. And diagnostic exams now have increased over the last 20 years or so, 20 to 25%, and actually radiation treatments have also increased. So this is an important issue. And this just shows how we estimate doses. We use all kinds of phantoms. I think probably you've heard something about that before. We also have a large absolute number. This is just some of the numbers from years ago, from 1991 to 96. We don't have any newer data. It shows how much medical X-ray exams are used. And in different studies, somehow I've lost something here. Different studies of medical exams. This is one of the few studies where we were able to get good doses and enough people to look at breast cancer. These are people who were exposed as adolescents generally as a way to monitor their scoliosis. There it is. So it was close to 5,000 women, women who were exposed and a smaller number of women who are not. And they overall had a mean dose of about 0.1 gray. And in this study, this was a mortality study, there were 77 deaths from breast cancer compared to about 45 expected. And the results, this was actually quite a high risk, 5, no, It's higher than one probably would have expected, but it is consistent with the A-bomb survivors. So it does show that if you do have a fair number of a cumulative dose of x-ray from diagnostic x-rays, when you're young, these were all adolescents, you do see an increased risk of breast cancer. Radiation treatment for benign diseases, as I mentioned, we have had fashions for this, but in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, it was used quite a lot for many different types of diseases, and it generally worked for what it was given for, but there have been long-term sequelae for many of these. I-131 is still the treatment of choice for hypothyroidism, so it is used a lot. So thyroid cancer is one of the cancers that is most radiosensitive, and so I'm going to use this a lot as an example for showing some things. This is a pooled analysis of 7 different studies. As you can see, there are cohort studies and case control studies, and it includes 120,000 people, and we're going to look only at the 450 thyroid cancers that were diagnosed among people who are under the age of 15. And as you can see, actually, there is again a very, very strong linear dose response for those that were exposed when they were young, and almost no dose response for those that were exposed after age 15. Again, this shows that although there is a difference in this case of males and females, it's not statistically significant, and it was actually different in the different studies. So I don't really think we can say yet whether females do have a higher radiation-related risk. There's some suggestion here that if you fractionate, radiation exposure, the risk goes down, but again, it's not statistically significant. This is interesting in terms, again, of Chernobyl and environmental exposures, that the peak is 15 to 19 years after exposure, but still, there's an increased risk all along. And the most recent data from the A-bomb survivors, which is over 50 years, again, still shows an increased risk. Here's just another study of people who were exposed to very high doses as treatment for peptic ulcer. And as shows here, the various doses that they received, that the stomach and the pancreas received over 15 gray. On the other hand, other organs received much lower doses, so that you can look at risks for high doses and low doses. And as you can see, there were significantly increased risks for some of the organs with the very high doses, the stomach and the pancreas, and also for the lung, where the doses were not so high. There's a big interest now in diseases other than cancer, so people are beginning to look at coronary heart disease and myocardial infarction, and there was increased risks in this study. The heart did get a fair dose, and you're seeing the same thing in the A-bomb survivors and in many of the other studies of people who were treated with radiation for cancer, so this is a whole new area of research. I'll just say a few things about people who were treated with radiotherapy for a first cancer. And this just shows the risk of lung cancer after treatment for Hodgkin's disease. You can see that there's a dose response, there's a dose response trend, but also this just shows the different types. Here's radiotherapy alone, but here is radiotherapy in conjunction with chemotherapy, and there the risk is even higher. There's another study and a very big concern about childhood cancer, because luckily treatment has been very successful for childhood cancer and these patients are surviving for a very long time. And so then you have concerns about second cancers. And this is obviously a horrible thing for somebody to develop. So there is a big study in the U.S. of 14,000 people who were 5-year survivors to look at not only second cancers but all kinds of other long-term sequelae. And this is a study that was just published a few months ago about thyroid cancer after radiotherapy. And they found a large increased risk, up to 30 gray, actually. At 30 gray, the risk begins to decline because of cell killing. And they also found that people who were less than 10 at the time of exposure had higher risks, and people who were treated for Hodgkin's lymphoma had higher risks. even when you keep dose constant. And basically, I think this is showing us that people who are treated for cancer as children really should be in follow-up for a good part of their lives, because you have to worry about their development of other diseases due to the treatment. Occupational exposures. This has become much more of an issue. We have a lot of nuclear workers and a lot of medical workers, but it's very hard to study them because their doses are low. So just only, and there's actually concern also about airline crew, because they can get some doses with many, many flights back and forth, particularly those that go across the ocean. So they can provide, though, actually direct information on low doses, so they're very important. Today, medical workers actually are our the most, we have most medical worker, radiation workers are medical workers, much more so than nuclear workers. And we've seen increased risks of cancer, well, there's a spelling mistake there, increased risk of cancer in the very early radiologists in the UK. They developed leukemia. In fact, Marie Curie died of leukemia. But over the years, obviously there have been standards to lower the amount of radiation, and it wasn't, we were hoping that there'd be no excess risk, so we're looking and trying to monitor both the radiation, the medical workers and the nuclear workers. Workers in the former Soviet Union, they had very high doses in the earlier years, and so there have been a lot of studies about them. Nowadays, as I say, the worker exposure is much, much, much less, and we're not seeing increased risks in people who started working recently. This is a huge study of 400,000 nuclear workers from all over the world. 15 countries were included in this study, and the mean dose for all of these workers was 0.19 sievert. It's pretty low, but they had many years of follow-up, and 6,519 cancers developed with a pretty large excess relative risk, and more than I think most people would have thought. However, it is consistent with what you see in the A-bomb survivors. The increased risk of leukemia is lower than in A-bomb survivors of the same age. Most of these workers are males, so they compared it to the males, but again, it's not that inconsistent. So this suggests that if you have a very long cumulative dose fractionated over time, you can still find increased risk if the numbers are large. And it reminds people that they have to be very careful about what kind of exposure workers get. Medical radiation workers are harder to study because you don't have as good dose information, but we actually have been trying to study about 140,000 radiological technologists in the U.S. At the moment, we're trying to get individual doses for each of them, so I'm not going to be able to talk about this in terms of doses, but types of exposure, when they were exposed. It's a particularly important group because, as I say, they are the most, they represent most of the radiation workers in the world, and there are over 2 million of them. And unlike the nuclear workers, most of them are women. So our study, as I say, has about 145,000 people. 73% of them are women. And we have been studying them by sending them mail surveys and finding out about the diseases they have. In terms of cancers, we've been able to validate them, but not in terms of other diseases. And since we don't have doses yet, we've just been looking about when they started working, because doses were always higher, exposure was always higher in the earlier years, and it keeps decreasing over time. And as you can see, people who started working before 1940, when exposures were fairly high, they have increased risks of breast cancer and melanoma. And even the ones that started in the 1940s, they have some increased risks. Specifically, basal cell carcinoma is significant, but melanoma and leukemia are still also increased. And then to get another sense of exposure, we looked at the people who worked before 1940 or 1950 and just looked to see how many years they worked in those decades. And as you can see, for breast cancer, if they worked more years, they had a higher risk. Same thing is true for leukemia and melanoma. Hopefully in another year we'll actually have doses for these people. So just overall summary about the radiologic technologists, the early workers who had the high exposures do have increased risks, again showing that even if the exposures are not that high and protracted over many, many years, you still can find an increased risk if your numbers are large enough. Environmental exposures are the hardest to study because the dose information is usually the worst. And not very many people have environmental exposures, but of course they are the biggest concern, I think, to people, to the public, because they usually come as a surprise. It's usually a result of an accident, like Three Mile Island or Chernobyl. Usually it's a lot of people who get small doses. So I'll try and talk about two populations that have been exposed. People exposed to radon, what's called domestic radon, radon in their homes, and Chernobyl. So studying radon in the homes is difficult. One, just figuring out what their dose is, their exposure is, and two, people move around a lot, so it's hard to know. They, in each house, obviously, they had different exposures. So one study was done in China in caves. These people live in caves and mountains. And they don't move around a lot. So if you measure their cave that they lived in, it's for most of their life, and you get a much more stable kind of dose estimate. And you can actually extrapolate down from the high dose risks from minors down to these lower dose people who live in caves. And this just shows, again, what the dose response curve is, and you can see again that it's linear. And when you look at it compared to the, let's see here, these are the low exposed miners, and included, and these are the cave dwellers, and you can see that it's a very nice dose response. So again, it's suggesting that if you you have to make sure that people are not exposed to too much radon in the home, and that having action levels really is kind of an important thing. This just shows what happens with radon in smokers, and that there is an interaction between radon and smokers. This shows how you get exposed to radiation when there is either fallout or an accident like Chernobyl. Basically, there's radiation in the atmosphere, and that goes onto the ground. Cows eat the grass, and then people drink the milk, and that's the major exposure pathway. So, as you probably know, it's now 20 years since the accident in Chernobyl, and that was the worst accident in nuclear history. And there was a widespread exposure over almost all of Europe, but the main places was in Ukraine, Belarus, and parts of Russia. And there was an immediate big increase of thyroid cancer 4 or 5 years later. It was already documented. But there was questions about whether this was due to examining people more or whether it was actually due to the radiation itself. So I'm going to go through this very, very quickly. But the most recent case control study really has shown that there is a linear dose response from the radioactive iodine, specifically I-131, and thyroid cancer in children. This can be modified by whether there's iodine deficiency or not, and whether prophylactic iodine is given. And in Poland, where they immediately did give prophylactic iodine, they had no excess thyroid cancer. So that's certainly an important thing in terms of planning for accidents. And I know in this country, the American Thyroid Association has been suggesting that we should have prophylactic iodine available. I don't know what has been decided in all cases. There were a lot of people who said it wasn't specifically the iodine-131 that caused it, but some of the other iodine isotopes, especially the short-term one, but this shows clearly that it really doesn't matter whether you're looking at total dose, the I-131 specifically, or any of the iodine isotopes, the risk is about the same. And this shows that it's still continuing. 2002, those are the latest data that we actually have, you still see this increase in risk. There's some differences between radiation-related thyroid cancer and sporadic. You can see here that it occurs at younger ages. And there's a slightly more aggressive type of papillary carcinoma that occurs. And it's not really clear yet whether it's only due to the radiation exposure or if it's due to the fact that these are particularly aggressive cancers that are diagnosed very early on, that in other words have a short latency. Because it appears that the thyroid cancers that are being diagnosed today are not as aggressive as the ones that were diagnosed earlier. So overall, the main increased risk for following Chernobyl is thyroid cancer. In fact, there really aren't statistically significant increased risks of other cancers right now. And again, the risk appears to decrease with increasing age and exposure. We're not seeing much of an effect among adults, but we have to wait and see what happens with that over the next 10 to 20 years. The risk is still continuing. That's not changing. The risk is somewhat larger in women, but it's not clear whether you're not seeing this in terms of radiation-related relative risk, so I don't know whether it's a biologic, not necessarily a biological difference. Iodine deficiency does appear to make the risk higher. And the risks that you're seeing for iodine-131 are similar to what was seen in the past, external radiation. So some of the new cohorts that will be studied in the future, there are thousands of people who were exposed to fallout from the Russian nuclear weapons testing in Kazakhstan and in Russia. Studies are going on there. When Russia was trying to build their bomb, they built a facility for plutonium production and processing in Ozersk, Russia, called the Mayak Nuclear Facility, and they dumped some of their radiation in a river, similar to what we did in the U.S. with Hanford dumping it into the Columbia River, but in Russia it's a very, very small river and it's a very slow river. And so people who lived along the river were exposed to strontium and cesium. The nuclear workers are also being studied. Sorry, that didn't get on here. That's about 26,000 people, and they're finding increased risks of all solid cancers and leukemia associated with external radiation, and increased risks of lung, liver, and bone associated with plutonium. And it's the first time, actually, that statistically increased risks have been shown in a human population exposed to plutonium. Also, the people who live in the city next to the Mayak facility, the Ozersk population, we're looking at exposures there. There's some hint from preliminary results that there's an increased risk of some thyroid diseases. And then there are studies going on the airline crew where increased risks of melanoma have been shown, but that's not clear whether that's due to exposure from the air, being in the air, or because the pilots and the flight attendants go for vacations frequently and lie out in the sun. So that still has to be investigated further. So thank you very much.